The Athletic.
Hello and welcome to the first episode of the Race IndyCar podcast in 2024. Wish everyone Happy New Year. Hope you've had a nice holiday period. Welcome back. And I've just had a late Christmas present because JR Hildebrand's got a new computer. So everyone who listens to the pod on the regular can laugh and enjoy. Bit of an inside joke, but I think it's fair to say there's some simmering tension with your laptop being pretty rubbish over the past however long we've done over 100 episodes of this podcast, where you can't always log on to Zoom, but now you're hooked up with a new laptop, so there's no excuses now. I hope everything's going to be all right.
That's right. It's just on me if it's not dialed in at this point. So we'll take it as it comes, Jack. We'll take it as it comes. It's kind of a sore subject.
I hope it picks up all of your wisdom. That's what we're hoping for. So I'll give you a rundown of what we're doing today. Obviously, it is the start of 2024. What better time to pick out some of our key themes from the year? So we've picked out five things to watch in 2024. If you're a regular listener to the podcast, you might remember that we did this last year. By all means, go back, listen to that one and laugh at us for all the things we got wrong, all the predictions we made that didn't come true. And maybe there was a few in there that did. So hopefully on today's show, we're going to pick out some of the things that will happen, or some key themes to watch throughout the season. And yeah, JR and I are just going to riff on those and see what we come up with. So I guess, JR, we should pretty much head straight into it because we've got quite a lot to cover. We've narrowed it down to five. We could have done about 300 things to watch, but for the interests of people not wanting to listen to a 9-hour podcast, we thought we'd slim it down. So I guess the first kind of topic is kind of centered around Scott Dixon and Alex Palou. We've seen Alex Palou beat Scott Dixon in two of his three Ganassi seasons now, which is quite significant. In the year that he didn't beat, in the year that Alex Palou didn't beat Scott Dixon, obviously had all of his contract drama going on in the second half of the year. It was pretty weird season for Palou, and he obviously didn't win a race until that last race of the season in Laguna, where he absolutely slaughtered the field, really, to be honest. Bit of a weird season, but Dixon came out on top. But even then, Dixon wasn't really fighting for the championship. That was a Penske year. So interesting, JR, to start with on Dixon. I guess, how do we feel about him being able to continue that form from 2023? I know this is a bit of a storyline that people have been talking about. Obviously, won quite a few races at the end of last year, but it's always difficult with the IndyCar kind of off-season. You always expect the teams to move around a little bit. We don't know what Chevrolet and Honda are going to come out with at the start of the season. We definitely don't know how strong Ganassi's opposition are going to be, but just from a purely point of like analysing what's going to happen, there's not a lot changed here. So in theory, Dixon should be able to come out and have a start like he did in 2020, where he won the first three races. It is possible. I guess, what do you think, and how do you feel about Dixon's chances going into this year, just based on what you've heard him say and kind of what you witnessed in the latter part of last year as well?
Yeah, I guess I think that he's got one thing that he does have in his favor compared to last year in particular, and frankly compared to the last few years, is continuity, just in terms of his engineer in particular, but I think generally across the team, he knows what he's entering the year with, and there's fewer question marks to answer for in terms of how everybody gets along and getting in the groove of things and all like that. So I guess I think that's reason to think that he can come out of the gates stronger this year than he has over the last couple of seasons. There's just been, and we've talked to him over the last couple of years, you know, up through the midpoint of the seasons, he's still just kind of getting, it's not, and not him as a driver, but with the nine crew and as the nine entry, basically, they're still just kind of getting their feet underneath them, it seems like, as they get partway through the season. And so, you know, there's a chance that enables him to just come right out of the gates strongly and be able to match Alex kind of punch for punch right away. I think ultimately the question is, can Scott, we saw last year, Alex basically had no weaknesses in terms of his game throughout the course of the season. It took some fairly bizarre and sort of extreme circumstances for Scott to win those races at the end of the year. Like he won them, and we talked about this at length, but he won them in a way that maybe only Scott Dixon could have done, but it sort of depended on there being the opportunity to do something that extraordinary for that to happen. Just not every race is going to be like that. There's going to be a lot of races over the course of the season that it's just, you're going to be on the same strategy as everybody else. You got to be able to qualify better than them and then be faster and have better pit stops and just do all of the little things as well or better than the other guy. And I think that's really where it just remains to be seen. I think on that apples to apples, even playing field, you probably would have said that Alex had a leg up on Scott last year. And so I think the thing that I'm interested to see is just with the continuity that Scott will have coming into the season. He's also been in the car a lot over the offseason doing a lot of the hybrid testing. So not that I ever would have thought of that as being something that would keep Scott Dixon from being his best self or something. He's always doing the 24 and Sebring, and he's just not the type of guy. I think Scott Dixon could be out of the car for 5 years and show up and be super like wicked fast first session. Like he's just not the type of guy that needs that kind of time off in the off season, but regardless, he's had it. And so it can't hurt. And, can he come out and basically match Pillow in the first stanza of races over the, first part of the year in terms of just outright pace, basically, because I think we've just sort of just seen that the IndyCar series, you have to get a lot of things right to be the champion in the IndyCar series, but more often than not, it comes down to being able to just extract the performance. And certainly to beat Alex Palou last year, that was a prereq. Like you were going to have to do that. So I think that's really what I'm looking for. I mean, Scott has the advantage, like we saw at the end of the year last year, of maybe if you looked at it as an also or an instead of, being able to do some really amazing things with the race car in, extenuating circumstances, let's say. But as we saw last year, also, you can't rely on that to be in genuine championship contention.
I guess with just kind of moving on to Pillow a little bit as well, I guess listening to the content day where all the drivers speak over the last sort of week just before we've recorded this now, the kind of common theme was basically that you can no longer have a bad start to the IndyCar season because it's so important to get that momentum at the start. And I guess people might say you would have thought that would always be the case. Obviously, you always want to start a season strong. No one goes in attempting not to start the season strong. But I think there's a common sort of acceptance between the drivers now that you can't really afford to have a bad start to the season because it's going to be so much more difficult to try and pull all of these points out of the bag in the second half of the season. We have seen it done in the past. Obviously, there is evidence of it being done and it's not impossible. But just as a sort of, if you're drawing up a season as a driver where you're kind of in the off season, you're thinking about how things are going to go, it's kind of like a prerequisite that you do need to have a really strong start to the season. I guess with Pillow, we don't know where his court case is going to go in the UK and how much that's going to impact the kind of first part of his season or even the second half if it drags on that long. We know it's already dragged on into 2024. He seemed very relaxed about it when he was talking at Content Day. He's got a new sponsor. He's with DHL now, so he's in some new colours. And he's had a baby in the off-season, which is, congratulations to him on that. I don't think that's going to make an enormous difference. I think people are maybe looking at it from the outside, like, what's going to trip up Alex Palou at this point? And I guess this is where I'll throw over to you, because from a driver's perspective, how would you be approaching this mentally, in the sense that are you kind of, do you think that the drivers in the series will be chalking 2023 up to like extenuating circumstances? Because otherwise you have to kind of accept that Alex Palou is a level above you. I guess you kind of have to go into 2024 looking at it like, yes, Palou has had an incredible season. He's, not to take anything away from what he's done, but also that things have gone his way. And that given the chance, if you were in that car, you would be able to do the same thing and therefore, match him, and that he's not basically on this pedestal above the rest of the championship. I guess that's how you would have to approach it as a driver.
Yeah, from the outside looking in, that's how you'd be approaching it. But I can tell you without question that none of these guys are approaching it that way. You know, they're thinking, you know, because it's just the nature of how you think about these. We've talked about this before, but like, I don't think you do this as a profession without ultimately having like a level of self-confidence. And it maybe just self-confidence is even the wrong word. It's like, you have to just be able to tap into a level of optimism about what you're capable of doing. And so even if you find yourself having a moment where you're having a crisis of confidence or something, you still have some degree of optimism that like you can find your way through this because you've done it before at some point. And so I think particularly for Scott, for Colton, you know, even maybe Kirkwood, certainly Marcus Erickson going to, we'll talk about him in a minute, but like going to a new squad, being in a different situation, the Penske guys, any, all of the Penske guys, you know, Pato in particular, I think at Arrow McLaren, you know, maybe throw Rossi in that mix also, that there's a group of drivers, and we might say, just from a performance point of view, let's pick out McLaughlin, Newgarden, Pato, and Dixon. Just for the sake of it, you know, those are the guys. Colton had kind of an off year last year. Marcus is switching teams, so the rest of those guys, they're in the same situation that they've been in. They're at the same team that they've been in. We would consider them to be among the elite guys in this, like the truly, truly elite guys that are in their prime, you know, in the field right now. We'll say that Scott Dixon is still in his prime, just because he hasn't really shown any particular, you know, evidence that's gone away from him yet, and he's in the same squad as Alex Palou and won a bunch of races at the end of the year. So combining those two things together, like where were these guys at points last year, and how do we kind of think of them in terms of their status in the series? That I think every one of those drivers is coming into this year, you know, I would say the right attitude for any of those drivers to have is, there were points during the season last year where we had Alex Palou's number, whether that was winning races that he didn't, whether that was there's some discipline that we were, you know, better than him. You know, Newgarden would certainly kind of, you could pick him out and say he was clearly better than everybody at certain places without question. Every one of those drivers showcased on each other type of track, road and street courses, where Alex ultimately kind of dominated. Was that they showcased at one point or another that at those places with the team that they're currently at, that they were just as good as he was. And that might have just been through a couple of practice sessions, and then it didn't really materialize in qualifying, and so it didn't materialize in the race or whatever. But as a driver, you know, where that optimism kicks in is you really remember those moments where you kind of had it all together, but just didn't quite execute for one reason or another, or it didn't all come together. And so every one of those guys to me is in a position, in addition to some other drivers that are outside that group, are in a position with their teams to be able to go back to those kind of moments, figure out the other part of this is you have to look beyond your optimism and be really honest with yourselves about like, what was it that made it so that ultimately we didn't get the result and Alex Palou did? But they're all within the skill set range to be able, potentially, along with their teams, to kind of reverse engineer that and at least be able to identify, like, if we had maybe done X, Y, or Z, if as a driver I had executed better in these moments, if as a team, we realized that for qualifying at that race, we like picked the wrong direction with the setup or whatever. You're going to have to get into like the really nitty-gritty stuff to figure it out. But there is a solution for all of those other elite drivers that put them in, you know, the Alex Palou performance category, I think. And so I think you ultimately, these guys are not coming into the season thinking, I need Alex Palou to have like a bad year in order to, I need Alex Palou to not repeat what he did last year in order to be competitive. I think they're all coming into this thinking, I've got all the tools required to do this, whether that's factually true or not. And we've just got to do a little better at all of these different things. Because I think really, when you look back at the season, there were probably all of those drivers that I just mentioned, again, maybe a few others, had a few things gone a little differently. Like, they didn't have to go differently by a lot. They would have been in much more genuine contention, at least by the time the last couple of races rolled around. So, it's going to be a hard thing for anybody to do. I think it's just as likely that Alex Palou wins another championship as it is that, like, you might take Alex Palou over the field, basically. But because of the way the IndyCar is, and because of how good, especially that kind of other group of guys that we're talking about here are, and because of how good their teams are, there's, you know, I don't look at this as, I don't think that this is like going to be another situation that Alex Palou just runs away with it. Like, it might, it's going to depend on somebody else and their team basically getting a little bit better. But I personally believe that any of those guys as combinations with their teams can.
I would agree with that. And I would say I'm kind of expecting Alex Palou, well, I think he is the championship favorite and would expect him to perform in a similar way that he did last year. I think expecting him to have a worse finish of eighth over the course of a season next year, like, I don't think that's going to happen again. Like, I don't want to take anything away from his achievement and what Ganassi was able to do with him and that car. But the, you know, just not having a finish like that is, and you know, people could, you know, quite rightly point out that, you know, Scott Dixon's only, like, what you would call DNF was the crash with Pato at Long Beach. And aside from that, you know, he was in the top 10 at every race as well. So they're obviously doing something very good with reliability there. They're obviously churning out really well-made cars, and Honda have done a great job with those guys at Ganassi as well. So not to take anything away from what happened last year, it just seems too ridiculous to me that you can go through 17 races and your worst finish is eighth. But maybe that's just, maybe we're going to find out this year that that's the new reality that we're in IndyCar racing. But yeah, I think you're right. I think it's going to be a combination of maybe not quite as good a season from Alex Palou and a little bit better from everybody else that's going to make this a bit more interesting. So we'll definitely keep an eye on that. All right, JR, you quite rightly pointed out that we're going to move over and speak about Marcus Ericsson and Andretti. We didn't just have to re-record that bit because I said Ganassi, because I'm still talking about Marcus Ericsson and Ganassi. It's going to take me a little while to nail that on first go, I think, JR. But yeah, Marcus Ericsson in Andretti overalls for the first time this week, or his proper 2024 overalls anyway, with his new dark blue Andretti car. The question we've got written down is, can Ericsson change Andretti's fortunes? Obviously, with these kind of things, it's never as just as simple as Marcus Ericsson coming into Andretti and then suddenly being fantastic at everything they do. But I think it's a nice starting point for us to bounce off. I guess we spoke a little bit when he was announced about what he might bring to the team and what his kind of appointment might do a little bit more generally. He's obviously a very consistent driver. That's something that Andretti's kind of lacked in races, a little bit of execution problems through at least the last couple of seasons. And maybe driving mistakes every now and again as well, contributing to that and creating a bit of an inconsistent package on race day. We've seen with Marcus Ericsson, he makes very few errors. He's very consistent on race day. And I guess the other big thing is that Andretti have been waiting since 2017 for an Indy 500 as well. So it's a big kind of pull for them to get, you know, a proper recent Indy 500 winner in to kind of push that team forward. I want to start with the 500 with you, JR, because I'm kind of really interested in this. Do you kind of think, well, you know, we won't take anything away from Marcus. His 2022 victory was fantastic, and it, a split second decision in last year's race, and he could have won that one as well. We could be looking at, you know, someone who's won two Indy 500s in a row. But I guess let's frame it like this: how much will his stock rise if he can go in and be this successful at Andretti? Because I think they were pretty close to nailing something last year with Kirkwood, especially. He was speaking earlier this week about his Indy 500 and obviously had that where he got caught out by Rosenquist and the wheel went into the car parking lot in the 500. But he was fifth at that point and had been working towards the front of the field. And Kyle had said earlier this week that he just felt like it was a case of what could have been if he'd have just known what to ask from the car a little bit earlier in the 500, like if he had that experience to be able to be a little bit more confident about the direction of the car and ask for things a little bit differently. He feels like he could have been, even further up at that point, might have even been in a better position. And obviously the fundamental Andretti car won the 500 in 2021 with Mike Shank, although obviously it was run by them and things were done a little bit differently. So even though the finishes don't look great for Andretti, we're not looking at a team that is like a million miles away from being in contention for winning the race or at least being in the conversation. I guess if Marcus comes in here now and sort of takes his team to another level, that like his stock has to go up even further, doesn't it? Because he's obviously kind of clicked on something that works at the 500. He's not been in IndyCar very long, come from Formula One. Obviously, ovals was a new discipline for him, et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, I'm just kind of really keen to work out what it's going to look like at the 500 and whether he is going to come in here and look like a kind of step ahead of Colton and Kyle, or whether they're all going to be, a little bit closer together than maybe some people are expecting.
Yeah, I think that to me, I'm definitely, if I was a betting man, I'd be putting some money on Marcus just this year in general, not outside of the 500 as well. And
yeah.
I'll give you my reasons for that. One is, I think that he's naturally coming from Ganassi going to be a little underrated. He's been in arguably the best car for the last couple of years, last 3 years. Maybe you'd say that Ganassi's, had the best, package on average. Basically, it has certainly seemed that way. Definitely the last couple of years, and for sure at the Speedway. So those are the places where you've kind of seen him excel, or at places where, it was in some respects felt inevitable that it was going to be a Ganassi car one way or the other, and it ended up being him. So that's easy to, I think that's easy to chalk up to not being dependent on a lot of driver skill or something, or something special that the driver is doing. So I say that basically just to say that I think he's a tad underrated coming in, but he's catching Andretti in a year that I think as a team, Andretti is going to get noticeably better. I think that in part because of this whole F1 thing that's going on, there's a lot of scrutiny over the performance in the IndyCar series. They've, I think, very rightly chosen to downsize to three cars. That's going to mean more resources, more emphasis on the three cars that are only ever going to be, and we're ever planning to be, like genuinely competitive cars weekend to weekend. So he's catching that like at the right time. So he's kind of going from what in appearance have been like the best team to a minus B plus kind of team. I think it's likely that these two teams just in performance are actually closer together than they have been over the last few years. I think that will also be, I'm just guessing that will also be prominently showcased at Indy, where as a Honda team, Andretti has underperformed, particularly in qualifying. So you got to think that that's among the things that they're taking a big swing at, rectifying, basically, or reconciling, I guess I should say, for 2024. So all of these things are basically the fact they're downsizing to three cars, the fact that they kind of know that they need to find performance, the fact that they've been behind the eight ball at Indianapolis. Most of those things are one off season's worth of work to figure out for a team that is adequately resourced and funded to do it, which Andretti is. So I think he's stepping into a situation that is actually better than it sort of looked on paper midway through the year last year. That's going to enable him to come in at the Speedway, be fast. I don't feel strongly that he's going to be like better than Colton necessarily, but he definitely has at this point, he knows what it's like to run up front. He's spent a lot of time up at the front of that field over the last couple of years. He knows exactly what a really good car should feel like. And so he will unquestionably come with a degree of just knowledge and feel and experience that is not only valuable to the team to make the other two cars better, but just there's nothing like having that feeling for yourself to get your hot rod dialed how you want it, whether the other guys follow suit or not. And so I think I'm very high on the potential that Marcus has at Andretti. And then the only other thing that I would throw into that looking at the other races on the calendar is the Andretti package was arguably the fastest or among the fastest package at a number of races last year that for whatever reason between Roma and obviously Kyle was the one that did execute at like a particularly high level at some of those places. Colton couldn't quite like pull a whole weekend together making use of that. But I think Marcus is just the type of driver that if the car is giving you just, I don't want to say like easy performance, but if the car is sort of providing you that one lap speed, he's the kind of guy, I think, maybe even more so than the other two on that team, just based on kind of his pedigree and what his driving style seems to be from the outside, to make that like livable over stints when other guys maybe don't or can't. And so for that reason, additionally, I think there are going to be situations where, I mean, there were situations last year where, you know, Colton ended up just, you know, had wicked pace, but just drove the absolute hell out of the thing for the first 15 laps of a stint, you know, while the team is telling him that he needs to look after the tires and just kind of not doing it, or maybe feeling like he's doing that, but not actually, you know, not having the experience yet in those situations to know exactly what that means. Like Marcus isn't going to end up doing that. And so, I just think in terms of ending up with results, you know, in a way that we saw kind of Alexander Rossi do that at McLaren last year and whatever, Marcus is just the kind of guy that I think is going to be able to do that over the season. So yeah, I don't know that I would necessarily, just because he is making a change and there's still too many unknowns to like bet on him as a, you know, true blue championship contender at the end of the year. You know, I'm not sure that I'm putting him quite in that category for 2024, but I think he could definitely be, he could be just as much in the mix of that as he's been at Ganassi for sure.
Yeah, it's hard to disagree with any of that. I think I'd only add that he also, the kind of the style of the Andretti's car setup and the driving style that requires really suits Marcus. So there's at least a hope internally and with Marcus as well that they can hit the ground running there. I'd also add that Kyle Kirkwood had said earlier this week that he believes that Andretti haven't lost any personnel. So although they've dropped from four cars to three cars, that was one of the questions we were kind of asking at the time. When that news came out, were they going to be able to hold on to everyone and keep everybody? It looks like they've done that. So they're essentially spreading four teams worth of personnel across three cars, which should really help with their execution and some of the mistakes that they've been making on a race day. And yeah, I think the only thing that's really been lacking from Marcus is the kind of elite top speed that you would kind of expect out of a championship contender, you know, being able to go out and put the car on pole and dominate races from the front. That's not necessarily what Marcus has been able to do in the past. And I don't think anyone thinks that he can't do it. It's just that things haven't fallen that way for him. And he's struggled with qualifying, especially for quite a long time at Ganassi. And I think if there's any team you want to go to improve your qualifying performance, then I don't think many drivers would be upset about going to Andretti and giving that a go there. We know how good they are in qualifying. So this has all got, as we've spoken about before, has all got the potential to be a really nice combination. It's also got the potential to help out Kyle and Colton in the sense that they've got a bit more of an experienced driver who's going to push them for speed and results, but can also be there to, you know, give advice and bring a little bit of a different mindset, I think, because I think we've touched on this a little bit over the course of last season where we kind of had the whole Scott Dixon Pato Award thing where at Long Beach, where Scott had kind of said, well, you know, I don't think he'd said these young drivers, but he basically said, you know, people are racing me differently out here and I'm going to have to race them differently. And I think it feels like there's an inherent kind of, with the younger drivers, a greater acceptance of risk in the sense that they're more willing to take risks in pursuit of the rewards, even if it doesn't, like, for example, a gamble at the Indy 500, like Pato made where he tried to pass Marcus. That was a gamble Pato was happy to live with, because if it had came off, he'd have potentially won the Indy 500. Like that's the mindset these guys are in. Whereas I think Marcus Ericsson approaches races in a different way. I think you can sometimes argue sometimes that he's too conservative. Like you can watch him in a race and he might get overtaken by someone. He might drop back a little bit and kind of be in his own zone and not necessarily be, you know, blitzing past people and making like highlight reel overtakes. But he brings the car home and he scores good points. And he's kind of at the opposite end of that risk scale where he probably takes too few risks sometimes, but it rewards him in the long haul and makes him one of the most kind of consistent drivers in the series. And I think we've spoken to multiple drivers now who, you know, speak really highly of Marcus's like racecraft and how he races. And I think that's a big part of that he's not someone who really goes out and, you know, takes enormous risks, where I feel like Kyle Kirkwood is definitely one of those drivers who's willing to live with those. He's another one who's willing to live with those risks. And that's not me criticizing those two approaches, because they both have their pros and cons. You just have to work out as a driver where you kind of sit in those. I guess another driver who would be on the more risky scale would be Romain Grosjean. So we should probably move on and talk about him a little bit. We've obviously spoken at a fair length when he was signed at the end of last year about what this situation might come to. So you can go back and listen to that episode from just before Christmas, where we kind of broke down Romain's move a little bit and went into quite a bit of detail there. I don't want to retread too much ground, JR, especially as Romain's not been in the car between the previous time we spoke about this and now. So it's not... I felt quite sorry for Romain in content day, because he kind of sat down to answer all of these questions and was just like, yeah, I don't really know what's going to happen. I've not been in the car yet. I don't really know how this is going to go. We're aiming for top 10s and top 5s. We might not get there. We might get there. We might be able to win a race this year. We might not be able to, et cetera, et cetera. So it was a bit of a difficult interview for him, I imagine, in that sense, trying to provide some depth and insight. I guess one place we didn't really go with this is, what do we think Romain can do here with this opportunity? Because he's at a point in his career now where he could quite happily, I'm not speaking for him here, but I'm just talking about other drivers his age, could quite happily just turn up and take a paycheck, drive a car around and just be happy with the fact that they're still a relevant racing driver, a fairly, well, an elite level, let's say. And that they're happy to be part of the paddock, happy to be competing, but not necessarily someone who's looking to or expecting to win races or to turn this into some sort of opportunity that's going to, you know, push him to another team, a higher level team, let's say. So I'm kind of interested in this whole kind of like, where's Romain at and what is this situation? That's another thing we're probably not going to find out until we actually see him over the course of a race weekend and over the course of the first kind of half of the season, to see, you know, where he's at and how much he's pushing. But I guess, do you feel like, I guess I'm kind of in the opinion that no matter really how well Romain does here at Uncos, this is not going to lead back to a top level team seat. I think he's had that opportunity with Andretti, and it's unlikely that another team of that stature would give him a chance. But he can still leave this contract at the end of this deal with Uncos, having improved his, you know, how people view him in IndyCar and how they rate him as a driver, I think. What do you think about that? Would you agree?
Yeah, I would generally agree for sure. I think that it's hard to kind of completely like tie a bow on the whole thing, but I guess I think that he's... Well, I would say, for one, that you never know, basically. Like, if you go out at one of these teams and just like crush it, and if, let's say, he wins a couple of races at Uncos this year, somebody at one of those bigger teams at some point, I mean, maybe it's next year, maybe it's not, but, you know, Zach Brown could be looking for somebody that he just wants to be able to come and do that same thing at his squad next season somehow. You know, somehow there's, you know, a little bit of a musical chairs at one of these, you know, squads. And I think that as the saying goes, like, you're kind of as good as your last race, and that can work in your favor or not. I mean, that, you know, a lot of time, most of the time it doesn't work in your favor, but sometimes it can. And so people's opinions about Romain could change within a season, you know, just in terms of what they think that they can kind of get out of it. And some of that also ends up coming down to, let's say that happens, just for the sake of argument, you know, what does Romain believe that he's worth? And so what are kind of his, you know, demands on his side of the, you know, negotiating table? And, you know, there's a little bit of that, you know, we just kind of don't know, right? You know, how much how much does he want to be in a more competitive seat versus, you know, collect a paycheck or something? Like that's kind of always a question mark when guys get into that situation. I would agree that he's probably not getting a Penske seat or a Ganassi seat. He's certainly not going back to Andretti unless he does something just truly exceptional over the course of this year. So, you know, where is Junkos at in terms of their engineering squad? How closely will they follow the McLaren? You know, how much ego exists in all of that? You know, these are all things that can easily kind of put you in the window or take you out of the window, depending on where they're at. And I guess I just sort of think that without sort of placing any particular emphasis on one person over another in any of these situations, you know, Junkos, this kind of situation between Ricky and Callum, you know, last year, and then Roma and Michael in the same time, you know, those both became contentious. We have two of those same players on opposite sides of it, you know, in the same, you know, in the same hauler here for this season. You know, there's kind of just as many things that can go right as there are things that can go wrong, I feel like, for this combination. So it deserves its place on this list as one of the five most interesting things that we're going to witness over the course of the season. I have no idea where it's going to go. But I guess I would say to kind of look on the bright side, there is certainly the potential for this to be a race winning combination if they get everything right. I mean, there's no question that that's true. So, you know, I think that's what they're hoping to be able to execute on. And I think from my perspective, my hope is that they just don't have the expectation that that's going to happen or necessarily that that's going to come easily, because I think that'd be putting them in a spot where they're just going to be disappointed and frustrated and potentially like very frustrated at points in the season, which I think is not a good combination for this kind of group.
I guess the other couple of interesting elements to it, we spoke about this when Grosjean was announced that they were dealing with a little bit of inherent understeer at Junkos last year at times, and they tried to work through that through the season. But it'll be interesting to see whether they have dialed all of that out, because it's not something that Roman's capable of really dealing with by his own admission. So we'll keep an eye on that. Also, he's coming into a team with a rookie teammate, with Agustin Canapino, who's now obviously moving into being a sophomore for 2024. It'll be really interesting to see how much he kicks on, because he had such a fantastic rookie season coming from Super TC in Argentina, basically a tin top, a V8 tin top. So the way he was able to adapt, I think, impressed a lot of people. I think Joseph Newgarden called him the most impressive driver he's ever seen at one point last year, which was shows you the extent of kind of like how the IndyCar paddock feel about what he's been able to do. And, you know, I think I just hope he hasn't taken too much sort of like buoyancy out of the last race of the season, which was a pretty crazy season. But he was running up front on merit there. But I hope he's got realistic expectations for his season too, even if that is stepping forward a bit from what he was able to achieve last year. And I think if Roman's able to even replicate what Callum was able to do in that car, I think that would probably be a decent season for Roman, even though people will be expecting I guess it's Roman, so people will be expecting him to win a race at some point, or be in the top five, or be on pole, or something. And to be fair,
Andretti, I think that's like the unfortunate thing about like the whole situation is basically just that there's going to be an expectation that he's going to be a standout farmer, and I'm sure that that's the case internally also.
And that was fine, Andretti, because they have the capability to do that, but it's just not going to be the case here, unfortunately.
Yeah, and like that would be a fair expectation to have of that driver at that team. And so whether it's the driver or the team or both like falling short, then they didn't like hit on that. But that I think was fair enough. In this scenario, it's kind of like, without a deeper engineering squad or some kind of like, you know, we were talking about this just like off air that, okay, there is a partnership between McLaren and Junkos. There's no evidence that that has anything to do with the engineering or the technical side. you know, of what they have going on. Without something like that, you know, this is just going to be an uphill battle, because, you know, for better or for worse, for these guys, I mean, it's for the worse for these guys. Basically, the quality of the field is just getting more top heavy, you know, and so it's just going to be harder to compete. So for Agustin and for Roman, that, like, it's going to be hard for potentially either of those guys. They're going to have to really punch above their weight, basically, to, you know, to I think meet the expectations that people will have of both of them after last season, after the high points of last season.
Yeah, for sure. Totally agree. We'll move on and we'll discuss Christian Longard and Rahal Letterman-Lanigan, JR, because I'm super interested in this. I think short of Alex Palou and maybe throwing Canapino into the mix as well, Longard was one of the most kind of impressive under the radar drivers for me last season in terms of what he was able to achieve. I'm not sure you'll agree with that, but we'll get your thoughts in a second. He was the fourth best driver on road courses. He pulled off some really cool moves through the season, obviously delivered his first win at Toronto. And I think when it comes to a silly season in 2025, it seems a bit quick to be talking about that, doesn't it? But still, I think this all ties into a topic that we need to be watching, is that there's a possibility that Longard will be available for 2025 for other teams. And if I'm basically any of the top teams, I'm looking at him and going, yeah, I fancy a bit of that. So I think the big question here is whether Rahal can take a big enough step on the ovals to give Longard a car where he can be fighting for the top five in the championship, because he wasn't really that far off that this year, just based on what, you know, if you take the points for road and street courses for him, you know, he's knocking on the door of that top five and potentially even ahead of Marcus Ericsson. So I think when you consider the upside of what he was able to do in the road and street courses and like what that almost achieved for him in terms of the championship, if they can just make even like an incremental step forward on the ovals to the point where they're not just like consigned to 20th at pretty much every oval, then that's going to be enough for them to be at least like offering Christian something that means he doesn't have to leave. But I think it's going to be a really interesting kind of topic through the season. I guess we should probably lay a bit of context down in the sense that, you know, the season before wasn't particularly fantastic on ovals for Rahal Letterman-Lanigan in 2022. And then they signed Simone Sordo from Red Bull. And obviously that was a big decision to make to put him in as technical director into a team that was struggling on ovals when he hadn't done any ovals before. Christian's sort of quite keen to point out that they'd taken a big step forward on the road and street courses last season, which is true. And that's the one thing that, you know, he could have a really serious impact on. So also Graham Rahal has talked about the fact that they think there's some low hanging fruit that they were missing from the ovals, in particular the Indy 500 in 2023. So yeah, I guess first of all, JR, were you as impressed by Longard as I was last season? And yeah, do you think they can hold on to him, because he's surely going to be like one of the top people in the silly season for 2025 if he carries on like this?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the short answer to both is yes. I was as impressed with him as you were. And the second question, it's kind of like maybe, basically. I mean, part of it depends on where are there other openings. You know, does Will Power retire at the end of next season? Does Scott Dixon move on? Or, you know, like there's a couple of these things that are like, how many seats end up being kind of vacated? How many seats that are well funded end up being vacated? A little bit of it probably depends on whether Christian has another super strong season. And then the third part of it is, I think for Christian, for him to be able to judge where he wants to be or what his options are there. I mean, I think it's always a little easier to stay where you're at than it is to go somewhere else, because it's it's known, right? It's familiar. You kind of know the trajectory of the different things that are going on. And so from that perspective, what Rahal needs to be able to do, I think, to, if we were to paint a picture of a situation where there are potentially other vacancies that are sought after and that he's having a good enough season that he's going to be one of the guys that's in the conversation for those other vacancies, they at least need for Graham to be really competitive on the ovals. I don't think it's necessarily dependent on Christian having a great season on the ovals, but they need to showcase to him that, because I think the other thing that's just yet to be known, because Rahal's not been that good on the ovals, is like, how much does he have to sort of learn still? Like, we don't really know, you know, like how much of it is him versus the car versus whatever. And I think that he's a thoughtful enough guy to probably also have that question. Like, he doesn't really know for himself what it feels like to be super confident on an oval, because they haven't really had the stuff to, you know, give him that. So is he somebody that once he gets that, he's just going to, you know, adapt to it naturally? Or are they going to provide that car and Graham Rahal is going to be qualifying on the front row and running up front at some of these places? And, you know, he's still got some things to figure out. So I think what I like about Christian is that he's seen a lot like Marcus, you know, he seems quite even keel. You don't see him get super flustered. I imagine that he's that way also in terms of his sort of decision-making and his perspective on things. He seems to have, you know, a wisdom that does not necessarily come with the age that he is, you know, to be thinking about these things. So, you know, those ultimately are the knobs that I think will end up getting turned one way or another this year. What really are the vacancies? And so what's the market? How good of a season does he have? And just is the Rahal car in somebody's hands significantly better on an oval? You know, and that'll give, I think, both him and us a clearer perspective on, like, is he going to stay or go?
He was like that when he was 17, like super even keeled and like direct, and really, like, even when he was making his GP3 debuts, like water off a duck's back. He's always been that way. And I think,
I was just going to say, I mean, I think even like, I think it was just during the year last year, it was before his win at Toronto, maybe, that, you know, he like rattled off a whole interview about how he basically had like a, you know, crisis of performance identity. And his dad basically just told him he needed to like get back to basics and get his shit together. And he sort of did, you know, I mean, to be able to even take that seriously at his age while he's racing IndyCar and performing at that level, like, there's a level of humility required to sort of zoom out, recognize that you need to adjust something on your own, you know, of yours, that's like only you can tune, and then go out and do that and be better for it and showcase the results. Like, the fact that he was able to do that within a matter of races in the middle of the season, I think is something that's very impressive from just a, I don't know, perspective and mindset point of view for someone that's as young as he still is.
Yeah, it was before Barber, and he went and played golf before the following race and was like, I need to chill out here. I need to, like, because he's just so like hyper focused on the details and like making sure every part of like everything is analyzed and like everything is perfect all the time. And I think it was just important for him to take a step back and just accept that he needed to be a human being and live his life. You can go back and listen to the episode that we recorded with Christian last year where he spoke about that in a little bit more detail. You can also, by the time this podcast comes out, you can also check the hyphenrace.com, because there should be an in-depth interview with Christian looking at this season and some of his thoughts about some of that stuff on some of the points you raised, JR, talking about he doesn't really know where he's at on ovals. He kind of agrees, but did point out, and these are his words, that Graham has been doing ovals as long as I've been alive, which is a little bit egregious because he's not been quite doing it that long. But the point stood that Graham's got plenty of experience on ovals. And Christian said, I've basically been matching him, you know, especially over the course of last season on the ovals. But I think there's a difference between kind of matching Graham in a pretty average car and then being able to like extract that extra level of performance when the car is going to be competitive. So I think there is going to be a difference there. And we don't know, Christian doesn't know either, whether, you know, he's going to be able to extract that, because he's not been in that situation where the car's been good enough to find that out. But he's been pushing the team hard. You can read in the interview, he's pretty harsh about, well, not harsh, that's the wrong word, just quite direct and honest about what he wants from the team moving forward in terms of improvements and what they expect from him as well. They definitely expect him to improve on ovals if, you know, if and when the car improves as well. So you can go and check out that interview and learn a little bit more about how Christian is feeling about this upcoming year. I think the other thing to mention is just from a, like a kind of adding a little bit of meat to the bone here for the fans is that Christian and Ray Hall, like the people who are there at the moment anyway, are just such a perfect match in the sense that he's like the most direct guy. Like he is not beating around the bush when either when things are good or things are bad, like Christian is going to say exactly what he thinks, like how it is. And his engineer, Ben Siegel, and the kind of the rest of the team around him are all, they all work in a similar way in the sense that they're not going to be massively offended when Christian comes in and says like, this is not good enough or, you know, because they know it's not good enough. And that's the way they all operate together. And I think there's a level of appreciation from Christian that Ray Hall gave him his break in the championship when he was at a really difficult point in his career and didn't really have a lot of necessarily have a lot of options at that point when he was kind of, you know, in the Alpine junior program. So I think there's a really good working environment here, and there's a lot of respect from Christian for the chance he was given. And I can totally see if they improve the ovals that he stays like longer term and moves forward with this team. I can totally see that happening. So this question is not me advocating that Christian Lundgaard's going to leave Ray Hall and go and join a big team, because as JL said, we don't really know what's going to happen yet. I just think that possibility is there if they don't make a big step forward on the ovals. So that'd be an interesting topic to watch. We'll finish off with the ovals as well, because probably JR's favourite topic on this list, I imagine, Kyle Larson, is obviously coming in for the Indy 500 with McLaren. We've done a whole episode on this. We've also interviewed Kyle, which you can go back and listen to, in the kind of aftermath of him being announced. We spoke to him about how he was getting on and to talk a little bit about his feelings and thoughts about how this might happen. Obviously, we're quite a bit forward now, and he's not long rolled at the Chili Bowl from after us recording. That didn't happen too long ago. But yeah, he's looking forward to the Indy 500. I know that for a fact. A lot of this, JR, is going to depend on what kind of package McLaren and Chevrolet bring to the table, isn't it? Because I think there's a general acceptance from pretty much everyone that it's not unrealistic that Kyle Larson turns up and is good enough to win the Indy 500. And I mean, just saying that out loud sounds pretty ridiculous from a general perspective of like, this shouldn't really be, you know, be able to happen. But I think there's just a general respect at his ability. There's enough time in the car. He should get enough time in terms of practice to get up to speed and at least be comfortable in the car when it comes to race day. And we know if the strategy goes your way and you race clever and you do a good job in the race, then you can put yourself in a good position to be in contention to win. I still personally think it's very unlikely that he turns up and wins his first Indy 500, not least because McLaren haven't quite put together that Ganassi-beating package just yet. But also I feel like we've seen more and more over the past few years that there's, and you'll talk about this in a second, I'm sure, because I'd love to get your thoughts on it, but we've seen people like Callum Ilott, we've seen people like Romain Grosjean, we've seen people like even Alex Palou come over and do the 500 for the first time and be caught out at some point in race conditions where it's slippery, like you're hanging the car out. It's really like you're 20 or whatever laps into a stint and things are really starting to go a little bit sideways for you and the car's not underneath you and you push too hard or you're just caught out by that little snap that you don't expect or you're just beaten by that kind of thing. And I don't say that to kind of like draw attention to those drivers, just the fact that the Indy 500 is a very difficult race as is fairly obvious, and that even the best drivers can get caught out by little incidents here. So yeah, I guess I'm kind of in the, as I said, I'm kind of in the ballpark that I think it's very unlikely that he wins, but that even the fact that not just me but anyone is even contemplating the fact that he can win the event makes me very excited about just the prospect of him coming to the 500 and what that might do for the event.
Yeah, I think there's a couple of different ways, you know, a couple different sort of ways to frame it that I've been just thinking, because I've been asked this a number of times, you know, over the last, whatever, this last off season or something, just what do I think, you know, from NASCAR people, from just car people that, you know about this. There's definitely an element of like, people I think will be paying attention to the Indy 500, in a way that they might not have otherwise. And I think even more so than it was, than was the case with Jimmy Johnson, because of the fact not only that Kyle's doing the double, but that he's just, he's an active NASCAR driver in his prime, right? And so in the way that you had, you know, Fernando when he was in the, you know, Andretti car, that it was like, okay, he's in a super competitive car. He's, you know, in his, you know, I mean, okay, was Fernando in his, is he still in his prime? Like, I don't, when does Fernando's prime start and end? I don't know, but he was definitely, he was certainly still viewed as being like a very elite F1 driver and continued to compete in F1 for some period of time after that. I mean, skipping the Monaco Grand Prix to come and do the Indy 500. I mean, this is different audiences. So I'm not, this is not to say that it's going to have the exact same effect, because your global audience from Formula One is much larger than even the domestic audience from, for NASCAR is, but just in terms of the kind of relevance that it gives to Indy, it's, I think we're having a similar conversation, at least in terms of how that looks. And that's what, and frankly, that's what makes me excited about it, is that this is Kyle recognizing that his, that he A, might want to do this more than once, and B, that in order to probably be genuinely competitive, because that's what he wants to do, like, he needs to do it now. And that, what, for a couple of reasons, probably one, because he just needs to get on it sooner than later, basically. And then two, because it might take him some time to figure out, you know, I think he's driven enough stuff to know that you don't necessarily just get in everything and haul ass right away. You know, and so even though that it, even though it sort of appears that that's what Kyle Larson does from the outside, the reality of it is, I think he knows that there are, you're always, you, there's always something that ends up being difficult that you just like didn't, you hadn't done it enough to really like know that that's coming. And so, you know, if he was in the same situation that Jimmy Johnson was in, that he's racing for the team that is clearly better than everybody, in a super well-funded, you know, not one-off thing, then I think it would be reasonable to sit here and talk about like, all right, there's definitely not a, like, he's gonna be in the top 10, you know, like that year with Jimmy, it was kind of like, I, and this is nothing against Jimmy, but I think that was a car that you could have stuck a lot of guys in and they would have been as competitive as he was. And yet he was, even in that situation, not at any point in the conversation to win the race. And so that sort of gets to, so the one thing is to say that Kyle is in his prime. He comes with a skill set that arguably nobody in the modern era of IndyCar racing has come to the Indy 500 with. And so that, I think he's at a level of performance that is higher than I think any NASCAR guy that's come and done it in the past will have been at. I mean, he will have just a seat of the pants ability to drive the car through some of those situations that you were talking about. Like, if it just comes down to the track evolving and you need a guy to react to that and like make the right choice in terms of his reaction, I think that's actually where Kyle will do better than most rookies or, you know, guys that are kind of coming at this from a different place will do. But what remains to be said here is that at this point, there are probably 10 guys that I think will just be better than Kyle Larson, basically, because I think they're really good driving Indy cars and they're in equipment that's capable of being as good as he is or better potentially. You know, if we just look at the rundown from last year in terms of, yeah, you had a lot of McLarens up at the front, but in qualifying, but you know, there's all of the Ganassi cars are potentially in that group. The Penske cars, you know, it's, you know, they will figure it out and get better. You know, you had two Foyt cars that qualified inside the top 11. You know, it's just kind of like, You put all that together and then just think about the drivers that he's going to have to beat. Like, he's going to have to go beat Alex Palou, Scott Dixon, Joseph Newgarden, Will Power, you know, I throw McLaughlin in there too, even though he hasn't, you know, necessarily shown you know, he's just got more experience and comes with just as much kind of know-how from something different. I mean, for that matter, you can throw the Foyt cars in it. You can certainly throw Rossi and Pato in that. Like, so he's got to somehow do, not to mention Shank or Andretti cars that get better, you know, for this upcoming year. So I guess when I look at it, I look at it through a similar lens to like how I would look at showing up to race at the Indy 500, which is just look like it's just going to be a stacked group of drivers and cars that you basically have to approach it for race day, for qualifying and for race day, that you got to actually do a better job than all of them, like to actually be in contention for sitting on the pole or winning the race. Ultimately on race day, like when Kurt Busch came and did that, that's kind of prior to Jimmy. That was our last look at, that was the last time that somebody, you know, actually finished the race, you know, sort of impressively coming from a situation like this. I think Kurt was like sixth that year, maybe. Was that because he was actually better than, you know, the rest of the field that was behind him? No, that was because, as always happens at the Speedway, you kind of, you know, you benefit from other people fucking up. And as long as you just don't do that, you know, you kind of end up at the front. But that also is not a strategy that's going to win you the race necessarily. Like, you're going to have to beat somebody that's probably in at least as good of a car as you and has a lot more experience doing this if you're Kyle Larson. So, you know, I guess I bring all that up just to say, I just don't think our expectation, I don't think anybody should be having the expectation that Kyle Larson is going to even, you know, qualify or finish in the top five of this race. That would be super unfair to him, basically. And so I would rather that we look at this, like how I will be looking at this is, if he qualifies and or finishes in the top 10, that will be super impressive to me. And I think that's realistically like how we should be approaching it from the outside.
All right, that's the Indy 500's expert view on Kyle Larson. We hope you'll be beating him in this year's race, JR. We have to be biased, Jack, and hope that you're gonna make it, that you're gonna get it over the line and be on the grid. How are you getting on with that whole situation? What can you tell us at the moment?
I don't know, man. I mean, it's I guess I would say, just in a general sense, like, you know, and this is not a complaint in any way. It's just sort of the lay of the land, which is that, you know, a lot of the extra entries, you know, for Indy have just because of the nature of kind of IndyCar, but in particular this year, because of the fact that, you know, we've had like engine constraints that have made it hard for those entries to exist, you know, over the last couple of years. That maybe is slightly less so the case, because at least the manufacturers know what they're going to do. So I think there's potential for there to be like 36 cars probably from an engine lease point of view this year. But that those extra entries, because of the fact that the full-time entries are, and that people are having to gear up for hybrid, and it's just getting, you know, significantly more expensive basically because of that. You know, those extra entries are, you know, just more dependent on where dollars are coming from to support them than I feel like, you know, they have than they were like 4 or 5 years ago or something. And so, you know, it's funny, like I have to reflect back a little bit on, it's not like there's ever really been a bunch of options for where you might, you know, come and do an Indy 500 only seat. But, you know, up until last year, really, I always felt like heading into kind of the off season approaching the next year, that I had a couple of options, that it was just a matter of how they shook out or whatever. And I wasn't really on the hook for bringing sponsorship or whatever. What was in a position where I wasn't a driver that was on the hook for bringing sponsorship one way or the other. And the reality of it now is that almost all of those seats, just out of necessity, depend on, you know, sponsorship coming from somewhere. And so, you know, that's sort of just the nature of the business of racing anyway. But, you know, in my personal situation, you know, it's made it go from like okay, I think I, as long as I just do what I bring to the table, what I think I can bring to the table, and the teams know that and whatever, which I feel like I've adequately done over the last few years, that I'll sort of find a place to get hired to come back and do this, that regardless of that, basically, that it's dependent on going out and making it, making the value proposition of the whole thing make sense to somebody. So, that certainly hasn't put me in a position where I'm for sure on the outside looking in, but it's definitely a different, position to be in. So we'll see. I'm still holding out hope, Jack, like you are.
Well, that was the five things to look for in the 2024 IndyCar season and a little bit about JR's hopeful plans for the Indy 500. So I hope you enjoyed that. Definitely head to the-race.com and check out all of our IndyCar content, where you'll find features, news, etc. from me. Definitely go back and listen to some of our older episodes as well. Like we've mentioned in this podcast, a few of them. Christian Lundgaard jumps to mind, especially an interview with him, and also when we interviewed Kyle Larson as well. So they're relevant interview episodes that you can go back and listen to and hear about some of their thoughts on the season. We're back throughout the year periodically with various episodes. And yeah, we've got a nice driver interview coming to you very soon. Also, hoping to interview Angela Ashmore, who's going to be the third female IndyCar lead engineer, according to the series, anyway, that is in terms of the numbers. She's going to be working with Marcus Armstrong this year, and hopefully we'll get her on the show and have a chat with her in the next few weeks as well. So that's kind of what we got planned coming up before the season starts. So that's all for this episode of the Race IndyCar Podcast.
The Athletic.